Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkinet in Edinburgh. And this week I am not joined by Frank Cogliano because Frank is in transit to the United States. And anyway, I think he'd be kind of useless for this episode. Because the episode topic today is video games, and Frank has told me by his own admission he doesn't play video games except for FIFA. And this is an episode I've been wanting to do a long time, talking about video games and American history in video games. And I've been, as listeners to this long for the podcast know, I am something of a nerd. I've been playing video games my whole life. And so I thought it would be an interesting opportunity to talk about it. And joining me today, we have two very special guests, one of whom has been a special guest in the past. Our first recurring special guest is Devin Greer. Say hi, Devin.
Hello, everybody.
Devin, of course, people remember from our episode a few episodes ago, is a third-year PhD student working on the Scots
in California,
in the Wild West. She's a Wild West expert. And our other special guest, who is just about to depart Edinburgh after finishing his master's in research, is Miles Stanley. Miles, you want to introduce yourself and who you are and what you do?
Hello, my name is Miles Stanley, and yeah, I'm just getting ready to just finish up my master's by research. I study broadly slavery and abolitionism in post-revolutionary American history, specifically looking at Quakers in Delaware and Philadelphia and early Quaker abolitionism.
All right, enough of that nerdy academic stuff. Let's talk about video games.
Yay!
All right, because I think we all have spent a decent portion of our life playing video games.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I remember as a kid going out with quarters to the arcade, and I don't want to think about how much money I spent and or playing on my PC and all other kinds of things. And one of the things that I think we're all aware of in some degrees is how huge video gaming is as an industry, the way in which, you know, for many people, they engage more with video games than they do go to movies in terms of the economics of it. I think video games now has eclipsed Hollywood in terms of revenue and all kinds of things. And so I thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk about how video games influence the ways in which people think about American history. Because I think we all know when we talk about Hollywood, you know, Hollywood has a very powerful impact on how people understand the American past. You know, the images people have are as much drawn from Hollywood as they are from, you know, what they get in lectures in undergrad and books they read and what have you. And I think video games may have a similar kind of place. And so I thought we would talk about at least a handful of games that we thought were interesting depictions of American history. And I think a good place to start might be one of the earliest depictions of American video games, one we've all played, and that's Oregon Trail. Do you guys remember playing Oregon Trail as...
Oh, yes.
Yep, the best part of my elementary education.
That may seem more about... Never mind. All right. But so I think this is the game a lot of people encountered in elementary school. This is a game that was often sort of bundled with computers, so I mean, a lot of, you know, this was seen as both a game that was entertaining to play, but also supposed to be educational. Any of you want to guess when Oregon Trail, the game, was devised?
Was devised, or was...
What was the origin of
like
Oregon
Trail? The first incarnation?
Yes, the first incarnation, yes.
I'm going to say, like, 91.
I'm going to say people on the Oregon Trail.
People on the Oregon Trail were envisioning video games.
Yeah, this would be a great role-playing game.
In the 1840s, they said, lo, in the future.
They're going to be role-playing us.
Yes, they're going to be role-playing us with these machines. And
you know what? That's my postdoc right there.
Okay.
That's so much fun on the Oregon Trail.
The answer is 1971.
No way.
So you're both off by order of like 20 years or a century, depending on how you want to. And it was devised by a high school teacher in Minnesota using an HP ShareTime basic language on an HP microcomputer.
Oh, wow.
And
what kind of teacher was this?
He was actually, I think he was a student teacher who was sort of trying to
how
do
did
some...
How did he have the money
just like
to
really
act?
Get smart, though.
So he got access, I believe, to the university's...
Okay.
Computer, and then the school board or something had this computer, and the way students played it initially, there was no graphics to it, it was all text-based, And they didn't even have a screen. It actually printed out on a piece of paper parts of it. And obviously, that's not the version of the game that any of us played. It became a very popular game in the early 1980s. It got Borderbund, which was an early computer game company, made a version of it for the Apple II, and I think that was a version that a lot of people played in the mid-1980s. There were different incarnations going forward into the 90s and since. So who wants to give a summary of what the premise of Oregon Trail is?
Should I go?
I'm sure that to you, Devin.
So the premise of Oregon Trail, I think you started Independence?
Yes.
Independence, Missouri, and you can choose to either be a banker with a bit of money or a lot of money, a farmer. Do you know the other options?
Well, it varies on which version of the game you play.
Oh, right? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then you name your character, you name your kids, you name your wife, and then you have to depart a certain season, which I know is correct. I know they did a lot of research, I think.
Yeah,
and
so
you have to supply your way.
Yeah, you have to supply your way. You have to choose what to buy. You have to choose the weight of your wagon.
So, yeah, the basic premise of the game is you have to get yourself and your family from Missouri to the Oregon Territory, and you pass by certain landmarks along the way, and you've got a wagon, and the wagon breaks down at least once on the route, and you have to repair the wagon, and you have to hunt for food. One of the things they introduced in the 80s version is a little micro game where you have to shoot bear and deer and things with a gun.
You have Native American encounters once in a while.
You have to cross bridges, you have to cross rivers, you can ford the rivers and various other kinds of things.
Pump the wagon and float it.
And invariably, when you play the game, at least one member of your party will die of dysentery.
Yeah.
You know, and this is such an ingrained part of, I think, it's sort of a common experience. People, the you know, Mary died of dysentery meme, I think, is a part of common American culture, at least for people of a certain generation. And I wouldn't be surprised if more Americans know about the Oregon Trail today from the game than from anything else.
Yeah, because I think
I agree with that.
The most obvious things that I learned from the game were, one, it took a lot to prepare for the trip, which was obviously important back then. And two, the journey wasn't very easy. Someone almost always died. Your whole family usually didn't get there. And it wasn't very fun. So yeah, if it taught me history lessons, I think they were quite correct. And
well, something that I thought was really interesting about the Oregon Trail is that, you know, because you start out with like high hopes, you're gonna have all this stuff in your wagon, and then, you know, you get going, you realize like we don't need a table set, like we're just gonna ditch that, and like you have to like watch the weight of your wagon as you're accumulating fresh food or as you're trading with people, but then you're also dumping stuff. And that's something that I learned about later, was that, like, you know, the trail itself is littered with just like useless artifacts that people are just pitching as they're going down the trail, you know, and that I thought was super interesting.
One of the things I really like about Oregon Trail, thinking about it as a historical artifact in and of itself, is if you look at different versions of the game, I've not played the 1971 version with the printer thing, but I've played a variety of versions from the 80s into the 90s, is there's a ways in which the game is reflecting changing ideas about what the West looked like and changing kind of historiographic trends. Sorry, I'm getting nerdy again in different ways.
That's what we're here
but,
for.
Exactly. But, you know, the earliest versions of the game, the sort of 1980s version, the West is pretty empty. You don't encounter very many of any people on your route between Independence, Missouri, and Oregon. You know, it is a largely empty West, devoid of people, devoid of, you know, you have these landmarks that you pass on the route, you have these various rivers and mountains you have to cross and different things.
And forts and things, and too.
But less so than in later versions of the game. You'll notice that it's a much more densely populated West. There are far more forts, both Native Americans you can interact with, and settlers and travelers who have already paved the way before you. So it's a much more diverse West. In one of the versions of the games, this is one of the versions my children played with, you know, the main character you interact with at the beginning of the game is an African American. You know, and so there's a not only, you know, it's a multiracial West, which much more reflects, you know, I think the historiography of the West, where our sort of, you know, the earliest versions of the game are very, in some ways, kind of whitewashed, empty West. Sure. And the later versions of the game have this much more heterogeneous quality to them. The other thing that the later versions of the game do is they actually make give you choices about where in the West you want to settle, even though it's still called Oregon Trail. You could go other places. So you could go to Salt Lake City if you wanted to go to Salt Lake City. So you could explore different sort of routes through the West that interest you. And you make more choices about, you know, in the earliest version of the game, it was all about surviving, getting to Oregon. Mm-hmm. In later versions of the game, they were also emphasizing, okay, now that you've gotten to Oregon, what do you have with you to make yourself successful? So there were things like you could bring seeds, you know, and that would be useful when you got to Oregon, or you could bring a piano and set up it, you know.
Usually pitch that.
Okay. No, usually pitch that. But on the other hand, if you actually did make it to Oregon with your piano, it wasn't lost when you were fording a river, you know, that you could set yourself up as a piano teacher or something.
So when was the last version of the Oregon Trail? Because you're making me feel really old because I don't remember any of this.
That's okay. So there are versions that come out really throughout the 80s, 90s, and I think the last one looks like it came out on a phone in 2012.
All right. Wow.
I know there's one that you can play in browser.
Of the older, one of the older versions is now available, so you can play and you can die of dysentery.
It's still really fun.
No, it's one part of the reason why I think this game held up so well is it, you know, it has this sort of, you know, educational value to it, but it is kind of a fun game to play, and it has sort of good game mechanics. You know, one of the things about thinking about history in games is, you know, there's this tension where some people wanted to make educational games, but they weren't great games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and there's some people who make great games, and they set them in the past, but they're not good history.
Right.
And so I think Oregon Trail is one of those interesting places where those, you know, two things come together more so than most.
And you know what? Like, when we were in the computer lab, I think we had two games on our computer to pick in elementary school. We had either Math Blasters.
Oh, I remember that one.
Or Oregon Trail. And I wasn't much for math, so I always played Oregon Trail. But looking around when I was playing Oregon Trail, most of the other people were also playing Oregon Trail.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it still holds up as a game, even if the graphics are lousy and you're still clicking to kill the bison or whatever it is. All right, so I thought we'd just go around and each sort of mention a game we thought had an interesting depiction of American history.
Well,
Miles, you want to go first?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. The game that has had a big impact on my life is the Fallout series.
I love those games.
Fallout is absolutely fantastic.
I cannot tell you how many hours of my life I don't want to say wasted because that's not the right word.
Enjoyed. Yes. I've enjoyed many hours.
Dedicated.
In the world of Fallout. Mm. It's a really interesting premise. Basically, the world gets nuked to smithereens in 2077. In the earlier years, I guess starting at about 1950, there was sort of this divergent culture, you know, that kind of where, how would you say it? Like the America of 1950 remained popular.
So this is a game that a series of games takes place in the far future, but they sort of exist in a universe parallel to ours. And I guess the best way to understand it is the history that they live in is the same as ours up through about 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Fallout lore is that instead of inventing the transistor, they invented fusion power.
Right.
And so everything is atomic powered. So you've got your atomic powered car, atomic powered robots, and other kinds of things. But it has a kind of 1950s era aesthetic to lots of it. The music in the game is from the 1950s. Oh, the geography of it is often, you know, the real estate and the houses and things. But it takes place in the far future after an atomic war with China happens and the society it doesn't sound rebuilding, maybe the wrong word, but it's sort of...
They go underground.
It's 200 years after that when most of the games take place. But they often, I think, are using, you know, the history of the society this is supposed to be from is part of the game.
I think New Vegas is a great example of that. You know, when you go into, you know, of course, all the places in the world are based sometimes like really closely on a real place. I mean, Vegas is an example. You know, you have, they call it Fremont, Freeside, yes. Which is Fremont,
yes.
in just outside of Vegas, Old Vegas. And of course, like there's one of the gangs is the Kings, led by a guy who calls himself the King. Clearly Elvis. They all look like Elvis. They all wear leather jackets and have pomps. But I think that a lot of the groups are modeled on, you know, I think they have one group called the Great Khans, which are like a biker gang. And you know, there are some baddies that you got to contend with.
Some of the more, I think, recent games in that series really sort of tie not only to sort of more recent history, but actually some pretty deep history. So you mentioned Fallout New Vegas. The game before that, Fallout 3, takes place in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so it's got all the history of Washington, D.C. embedded within it. So they've got the Lincoln Memorial there.
And you go there.
And there are people who are slave trading at the Lincoln Memorial. And so you have to engage as an emancipator there. There's sort of references to, you know, George Washington and various things. A game that came more recently, Fallout 4, takes place in Boston. And there's a bunch of American Revolution related, you know, I guess Easter eggs might be the right word for it. So you don't need to know the history to play the game, but if you do know the history and you go to these places, they make sense in a way. They sort of draw upon history.
Right? Preston, yes. You know, another settlement needs your help.
Yes, yes. There's a group of characters called the Minutemen in the game, and you go to Old North Church, and so there's ways in which that game really does. You know, it has its own sort of lore and fake history, but it also has all this real history that it, you know, draws upon. So that's kind of a weird game with the history because it's about the future and the past simultaneously.
It's like this ever so slight mythologization.
Yeah.
But still trying to base it in history.
Devin, what's a game that you've...
Oh, gosh. Well, obviously... As a frontier historian, I'm going to have to say Red Dead Redemption. I came onto the game a few years after it came out in 2010, coincidentally when I was writing up my undergraduate dissertation. And I spent many more hours on the game than I should have from writing my dissertation. But you know what? I count it as research. I count it as research because I was doing my dissertation on the Pony Express.
Oh, well, I see. That's exactly
the same thing. Yes. Same-ish time frame, but not really. I was in my world. So the premise of the game is it's, I think the year's 1911, so you're set in the West as it's kind of disintegrating into modern times. So there's this weird...
It's a declension narrative.
Yeah? You like that?
Okay.
Disintegrating into modernity.
You could say it's modernizing and progressing.
But the West is such this like idealistic place.
So the old West is fading into the new West.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So they did a really good job of like integrating like all the modern things like the trains, the telegraph, with the kind of myth and the legacy of the old West.
Mm-hmm.
And you're this character called John Marston, and the game's pretty awesome because it's an open world game, which means that there is a storyline to follow and you have tasks to do, but you can also kind of go off and do whatever the hell you want. A great thing about it is you can decide whether to be an outlaw or a law-abiding citizen. So the game will pay attention to if you've killed people.
Steal their money.
Yeah, you can kill people and not do it in front of someone. You can still be a law-abiding citizen. You have to just be sneaky about it.
Sounds like you have experience with this.
Oh, yes, definitely. The game taught me a lot of things.
So the game is made by Rockstar, same people who made Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, so it's basically Grand Theft Auto in the Wild West.
Grand Theft Auto with horses.
Exactly. Though I do have a quip with that, because they don't work on the horses as hard as they work on the cars. I'll come back to that. But it's just a great game. You feel like you're in the Wild West. It feels authentic. The people at Rockstar did a great job at doing their research. There's this great feature where you can buy newspapers in the game for like $1. And they link up the historical events happening at the time. So the game writers have put in like World War I striking off, the cinema coming to town, Frankenstein showing in the local theater. And then what you do in the game also makes it in the newspapers, like this unidentified killer has killed our most favorite prostitute or something.
Okay.
I just completely fell in love with it. You part of the game also goes down into Mexico.
Okay.
You get in cahoots with
Pancho Villa.
You get in cahoots with Pancho Villa. Yeah. You walk into him doing something very naughty on a table with another woman. Yeah. Since I think it's what's the rating? M. It's rated M. Yes. But they just did a great job, and you feel like you're actually there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, when you say they did research, and you said it felt real, do they employ historians to help write the game?
You know what? This is what I want to do with my life.
All right.
I want to be a historical consultant for
game developers. If you're listening,
yeah, please.
You know,
I have a friend over at Activision.
No, no, okay.
Rockstar,
okay. Well,
I've been trying.
We're gonna do some networking here.
Yeah, definitely. I know they've got people who do read up on what's happening, especially the QA testers. I know for the other game they did, L.A. Noire.
Yes.
I know one of the testers who went in and to a house and saw a washing machine that wasn't the right time period.
Yeah, sure.
So they're pretty picky.
Okay.
About what they.
But that's more like narrative design, right? Like, you know, you're designing a narrative in a world, and that's what makes you feel connected to the characters,
I think,
the
because
narrative.
The world is so true to fashion, it just works really well.
Okay.
Of course, who knows if Pancho Villa was doing that dirty thing he did on top of the table?
Okay, it's a work of fiction. All these things are works of fiction that are embedded
within the particular. It's like historical fiction, basically. Well, it is historical fiction.
And I guess it runs into the same issue that movies have when they're set in period. And you say, oh, but that's not the right kind of clock for that particular
moment.
But
those shoes
aren't right for the other thing. Okay.
But you feel like you're there, and that's why I love the game so much. The only thing I have, like I said before, I have a quibble with is the horses. These guys spend so much time and research on their cars in Grand Theft Auto.
To be sure.
But when it comes to the horses, like, I ride horses. I have like a pass with horses. It's just something that doesn't look right. And that didn't help me with feeling
suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. I didn't like feel like I was on the horse. And it was kind of funny because if you go too fast and you piss the horse off, it'll buck you off. You can tame wild Mustangs.
Okay.
Which that's all cool. You have to do is lasso a horse and jump on it for about 10 seconds while it's bucking.
It's just like real life.
Yeah, if you stay on for 10 seconds while it's bucking, you tame it, and then it's your best friend and does anything for you. I'm just being really picky. I just found out in the new game that's coming out, I know this podcast M-rated, right?
Yes.
They worked really hard on making the horse's testicles, like, true to fashion.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's
but important. You know what? You've got to
learn some biology as long as learn some history.
But there's a historical inaccuracy with that because during the Civil War, did you know this? I bet you didn't know this, David.
The things I don't know is vastly exceeding
during the Civil War was the first time that the horses they used for the cavalry, they gelded most of them.
Ah.
Because they enlisted a bunch of men who weren't used to riding horses.
Okay.
And back in the day, if you rode a gelding and you didn't ride a stallion, it was seen as not very manly and you couldn't handle a real horse. But during the Civil War, when a bunch of these just normal regulars were enlisted, they're like, oh, they can handle the geldings a lot better. Let's just geld all the horses. And then after that, more horses started to be more gelded. Sorry, that's not even a word. It became more practical to geld horses, and it didn't really relate to your manhood anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you know that fact?
I did not know that. See, I'm learning new things every day. Thinking about sort of the accuracy that you pointed out, I mean, one of the things that modern games can do very, very well is have a degree of verisimilitude that say Oregon Trail back in the 80s didn't. Mm-hmm. The game that jumps out to me is a game that came out about the same time as Red Dead Redemption. That's a game you mentioned, L.A. Noir, which takes place in the late 1940s in Los Angeles. And it sort of picks up on a lot of sort of film noir and detective stories and whatnot that are set in the same time period. But they really get the geography of Los Angeles at least mostly right. Obviously, they condense some things. And alter some things to make the game a game, but it really does try to capture the flavor and feel of the city. Have you guys played L.A. Noir?
Yeah, it's a
wonderful game in as much as that it looks like a movie. They actually have a lot of TV and movie stars as the characters. They did some interesting motion capture things.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. It does in some ways capture some important historical themes about urbanization in the mid-20th century. The main character is a World War II veteran, so it talks about the veteran experience. It talks about ethnic diversity within a place like Los Angeles and the ways in which Los Angeles changed during World War II. They have the growth of the highways and suburbs. And so there's lots of actually important historical themes that we talk about, when we give lectures on, the post-World War United States that emerge in the game. And they're, there for color much, there's a plot for the game. Mm-hmm. The other thing I really like about the game as a historian is that you are in the game a detective, and you have a series of cases. It's kind of a crime detective game. But a lot of what you're doing is interrogating people and asking them questions and judging whether they're being truthful to you and looking for clues. Right. And so the game has a kind of, historians often think of themselves as being like detectives and trying to piece together stories. And so there is a kind of detective historian thrust to the thing. And I gather, with that game, they also try to get a lot of historical consultants, and obviously big video game companies can do that. But I wonder if, more broadly, whether video game companies do use consultants very often. And I get the impression, for the most part, that they don't.
Really?
And the reason why I say that is I wrote a review of a video game a year ago. A video game called Ultimate General Civil War.
Ah.
Of course I'm going to play this. It's a really good game. It goes through most of the battles of the Civil War. They get lots of the details right about you. Sort of your refight, mm-hmm. Gettysburg and other things. They get a lot of the details right about the geography and the size of the army, and they get the guns right, although, like most games, they overemphasize, one gun being slightly better than another gun,
right,
which
sure.
is probably more gameplay than reality. But the one thing they really totally left out of the game is the African-American experience. There's no question about slavery in the game. There's no emancipation. There are no black soldiers in the game. Even in the battles where you would have had black soldiers and where black soldiers being on the battlefield would have mattered. And I pointed this out in my review. I said, this is a very good game, but it kind of missed the major, when we talk about the history of the Civil War, nobody talks about the battles divorced from their political and social context anymore. And then one of the game developers wrote back to me and he says, we're just a small game development company. We can't afford historical consultants. What I tried to tell him is that historical consultants are probably a lot cheaper than what they thought they were.
Yeah.
But there's a sense that you can make these games either with drawing upon a large body of expertise if you want to, or at least reading, including the people who made this Ultimate General game, you know, had done a lot of reading about these battles, but they had, you know, not chosen to bring anybody in who had any particular, because they would have pointed that out to them, that this was an oversight.
Yeah, they don't have the skills that we historians have.
Well, or at least, you know, there's the questions that would come up to us about, you know, okay, you're doing a Civil War game. Yeah. How does slavery factor into this? Is something that would be obvious to us.
Yeah.
They're much more thinking about sort of how can we level the game and how can we make the gameplay dynamic work and, you know, how does...
You think they missed, like, a great opportunity for wonderful, like, narratives throughout, yeah. Like, you know, the black soldier experience, you know, like...
Yeah, so this...
You know, speaking of narratives, I'm going to mention another game called Valiant Hearts.
Yes.
Super Valiant Heart or Valiant Hearts. It's a game that was released about 2014,
I think. Yeah.
Okay, so 4 years ago, and it's about the Great War. And you play as an African American soldier, a Belgian soldier, a French woman, and I think a German soldier.
Mm.
And it's a side-scrolling puzzle game, and it's so invigorating and. You feel like you're there. And what they do is after each puzzle that you do, they give you a great narrative of what's going on in the world at that moment in time. So they set you up.
Mm.
So they set you up right after Franz Ferdinand was killed. They set you up right after, was it the Battle of the Somme? Was that the First World War? Yeah. And it was amazing. And it was such a simple design, such simple gameplay. But the way they were telling the story, and they were telling it in an accurate manner, so they weren't digressing from anything, and it wasn't historical fiction. It was history, and it was exciting, and I thought that was just a great way to.
So, who was the target audience for this game?
I think it was made by an independent company. Just gamers, really.
Okay, so this wasn't designed as like an educational tool per se.
No, definitely not. Just your average gamer.
But I think that sort of demonstrates, you know, you as a game designer, you know, as just as a historian, you make creative decisions. You know, it's like you can choose to rely on a narrative and really push that, or you can choose to rely on action or cinematics. You know, I'm thinking like Call of Duty. I mean, it's very linear.
Yeah.
You know, like the early Call of Duty, World War II, you know, you're 101st Airborne Division paratrooper. I mean, the maps are small. You kind of go through and then it's a cutscene, and then you go through and there's another cutscene. Or the narrative, you know.
Well, I mean, that's the one that you mentioned, you know, Call of Duty, because there's a whole category of games that are sort of Call of Duty and Call of Duty like, you know, that are primarily World War II games. Although I guess there's now a Battlefront, which is World War I.
Mm-hmm.
There's some that are Vietnam and other kinds of era, but these are very, very popular games, and they have been for generations. What is the game playing public? You know, what do they learn about the past from those games?
You know what? I know that the Call of Duty games do hire historical consultants, but I think they're more military.
Oh, sure.
More of the gun designs and
uniforms.
Gotta
get the buttons right.
Yeah. So people are learning about the correct buttons, but I don't know if, as far as the context.
I mean, from what I've gathered, I've played a couple of them. You know, it's all really focused on, you know, a particular squad, a particular group of men, you know, very like band of brothers. Mm. Like, you know, we were in the shit together and, you know, so we're, you know, and we're... I mean, it's definitely, you know, yay, America, we're coming in and liberating people and killing baddies. And,
there are certain kinds of patriotic narratives that are embedded within it.
Definitely.
You know, and they're I guess they're coming out at about the same time as the Band of Brothers HBO series.
Definitely.
And so they have, you know, and I would imagine there's an overlap between the demographic of people who play the games and watch those kinds of shows. You know, because I'm very interested in thinking, you know, just been thinking about this in preparation for this episode. You know, what periods of American history get covered a lot in video games? And we've got a lot of these sort of World War II games. We've got a lot. There's some games about the Revolution and a couple of games about the Civil War that are sort of real-time strategy games where you're moving armies around and whatnot.
You know what? I think the gaming industry is very much in sync with Hollywood.
Mm.
But I think it's still a step behind. Hollywood's going into stuff like slave narratives.
Mm.
I know there was a game back in the day about...
Yeah, so that they're, you know, thinking about sort of points of American history that, that haven't been done or haven't been done much in games. You know, you there haven't obviously been lots of films about slavery, although...
Like the difficult points of history.
You know, there's some questions, things that are just like, how do you make a game out of this?
And like, how do you make a game about the Holocaust? Like,
and not make it, you know...
That's true.
Trivial game.
Yeah, you don't want to trivialize the history.
Yeah.
So they did try to make a slavery game once called Freedom that came out in 1992. And I think it's by some of the same people who were involved in Oregon Trail. And the idea basically is you are helping a fugitive slave escape. But it sort of ran into two problems. One is it wasn't a particularly great, like the gameplay wasn't great. So the replay value... You know, it's not like Oregon Trail where you can, the replay value is particularly good. But there's also some points in which sort of the cartooniness of games in that period, you know, trivialized what you were, they were trying, the story they were trying to tell. You know, so there's lots of parts of American history that don't translate as well. But there's some surprising things that do. The growth of the railroad industry, for instance. They've made a number of games about the growth of the railroad industry. Sid Meier's
Railroad Tycoon.
And there's been other versions of that that have been remarkably successful. So those kinds of stories, you know, get told a lot. Things like Civilization, which is sort of a world history game, you know. But they have certain kinds of narratives embedded within it about progress, about technology, you know, if you've played Civilization, one of the first things you do is you kill all the barbarians, you know.
And you gotta get some gold.
Which you know, as a gameplay strategy sounds good. But, you know, when you think about what that means, transporting that into, you know, a history of imperialism in the real world, then it's slightly more problematic. You know, and as those games have gotten more complex, they've tried to add new levels to it, so... You know, Civilization at one point decided they wanted to add religion as a category. And how do you do that in a way, you know, so they start having missionaries and you convert people. And that's also has some problems. And so, you know, there are certain kinds of tropes and themes in video games that they're very, very good at. But there's whole other things they just don't do very well at all. They're relatively, you know, thinking about the games we've talked about, very few of them feature women in prominent roles. You know, and we're thinking about game. I mean, part of this has to do with the historic demographics, I guess, of the gaming industry, you know, which has obviously changed tremendously over the past 20 years. But and also the demographics of people who are making the games, which has also been changing. But you know, there aren't that many games, historical games at least, that feature women prominently
and without prominent.
Yeah, okay, there's Devin is making gestures which we cannot replicate on the podcast, which is not a visual medium, the way games are. But, okay, so there's the question of sexualization in video games that has been a particular point of controversy really throughout the history of gaming. But I mean, so they've never really done slavery. We've never really done the civil rights movement. Although, you know, there you see it in the backgrounds in some games, so like in L.A. Noir, they have questions about that. There's a game called Mafia, I think one of the sequels of which deals with the civil rights movement. How does this shape, you know, thinking about students who end up in our classrooms? You know, if video games are one of the ways in which they receive the past, you know, between thinking about sort of a triumph or between... You know, video games are one thing, they trips with their parents, maybe movies, and then finally like what they learned in high school. How have video games influenced the ways in which people think about the American past?
I think it puts a greater onus on the video game manufacturers for historical accuracy. One of the reasons I study history is because I played video games when I was a kid, and I got into World War II from Call of Duty.
Okay.
And, you know, and then I realized that Call of Duty is not anywhere near, you know, what was really going on. And I found a different part of history. But, you know, I remember just asking asinine questions to my professors based on Call of Duty. Yeah. Like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yes. Let's talk about the number of buttons this guy has on his uniform, right? You know, so they do have, you know, narratives of, that are tropes of video games that, you know, historians really don't care too much about. But,
yeah.
I think it's a wonderful outlook into the past.
Mm.
You've got people who don't like reading. Like, I don't really like reading. And I know a lot of video games aren't that historically accurate, but I think it's a great avenue to witness and experience the past.
Mm.
Like Miles said, who would have known if you would have gotten interested in World War, like, you know, without Call of Duty?
No, I mean, probably would have been Band of Brothers then.
Yeah, mm. Well, there's Hollywood helping out too.
Yeah,
but I think it makes people more interested in history.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Hollywood does. There's a lot more historical films out now and series and...
Yeah.
The amount of stuff on Amazon Prime and Netflix now about random historical eras are just...
Yeah, no, that's true.
I mean, one thing that I think historians as a discipline haven't done yet is, I think historians have really embraced movies, you know, and so there are courses you can take at the university level on history in the movies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And lots of books have been published on the ways in which different historical periods are portrayed in film. I don't think the history as a profession has really done that yet with video games. And part of that may be that the generation who grew up playing video games and for whom video games is an important part of their life,
mm-hmm.
you know, the oldest of us are in our...
50s. I'm kidding.
In that range of ages, yes. But, you know, the people for whom video game was an important part of their identity growing up, you know, I think is still, you know, maybe not there in terms of shaping the profession as making this a legitimate field of study.
Well, that just means we have a little bit of work to do, man.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, to be sure. Because I think, you know, video game industry, if anything, is just going to grow over the next coming years and decades, and the ways in which, you know, they're going to use realistic portrayals of the past as settings for games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think historians need to interact with that because, you know, students are going to be interested in our classes in part because of experience they have playing games. I mean, I remember a few years ago, when I was teaching in North Dakota, Assassin's Creed 3 came out,
mm-hmm.
Which, for those of you who haven't played it, has a very complicated mythos of its own. But this particular iteration of this game takes place during the American Revolution, primarily in Boston, and lots of students signed up for my American, when I was teaching the American Revolution class, and I think some of them were inspired, at least in part, by playing that game. Now, there's elements of that game that depict 18th century Boston very accurately, but there's also points where you can jump off the top of churches and
land a bale of hay
perfectly fine, and other weird time travel things and magic and other things. But in some ways, the experience of playing the game is I guess the closest analogy I had to it is sort of like visiting, you know, Colonial Williamsburg. You are immersed in a particular setting, and you can interact with pseudo George Washington and pseudo Ben Franklin and pseudo, you know, these sort of versions of historical actors, and also do some weird fighting things that I wasn't very good at.
But that's really the thing, though, is that, like, these video games are just getting more and more immersive, and you are getting, you know, further deeper into these worlds.
Mm.
And I mean, that just gives millions of little opportunities to be able to explore every facet of these worlds.
Yeah. So the student who may not have an interest in the American Revolution may have an interest in Assassin's Creed, and then gets to the American Revolution through it.
Sure.
And you know what? In a lot of aspects, I don't think that a lot of American history needs to be fictionalized. One of the reasons I love history so much is that it's just such an exciting story.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of stuff I read in the archives, it's just like these crazy stories about these men on the frontier on the Oregon Trail, on their way to settle. They are on the way getting off their horse, and they trip, and their gun falls out, and they get shot in the bottom. Like...
That was not in my version of Oregon Trail. But no. Maybe you should be the next version.
This is in the archive.
I know, but that's why you should...
exciting stuff that us as historians have access to in these dusty archives.
Oregon Trail 2019. That, exactly. With Devin as a historical consultant.
That game designers would like love to tell these stories, and they're true. They don't have to make up these stories. Yeah. I think it's just an incredible outlet.
So I think we need to figure out ways to have those modes of communication work better. Yeah. Or game developers and historians, I think we have a generation of game playing historians who want to do this, and I think those networks need to happen.
Yeah, like the amount of stuff I just read, I'm like, that would make a great video game.
Okay. All right. Well, so game developers are listening to this. Devin and Miles are both in search of consulting gigs. As am I, for that matter. I wouldn't mind playing a part of this. Thank you very much, Fries, for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, David.
Until next time. Cheers.
Adios.
Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.